All right.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. Call our first case for today, 058P1189CR, State v. Monica Lackershire. Representing Ms. Lackershire is Stephen P. Weiss, Assistant State Public Defender. Mr. Weiss.
Thank you, Judge. Good morning. Monica Lackershire is a mentally and physically challenged person. She suffers from learning and cognitive disorders. She has a 10th grade education, a history of psychiatric problems and hospitalizations, difficulty reading and comprehending, and she's legally blind and lives on Social Security disability.
Is that the reason that she gets SSI is for her visual impairment?
I believe it is, yes, Your Honor. It's not specific in the pre-sentence report other than that indicates that is her main source of income when she's not incarcerated. There are three sets of issues concerning her plea that are being raised today. There are issues related to the existence of read-in charges, issues related to the elements of the crime to which she pled, and issues related to her pregnancy. We submit that the read-in issues and the element issues contain so-called Bangert issues involving defects to the plea-taking proceedings themselves.
Can I ask you specifically on the Bangert issue, which we have in the file here, which was gone over, I believe, by Judge Radcliffe, that she answered the questions. There were the 10 questions, and that she went through each one, and then she initialed. And what is the defect in the questionnaire itself, the Bangert? What is the defect?
We're not submitting that there was a specific defect within the plea questionnaire.
Okay. Well, what's the Bangert? What is...
Our Bangert arguments are that the plea-taking proceeding was defective in for two different reasons. The first of all, with respect to the read-ins, is that the existence of read-ins was never mentioned anywhere in court at the time of the plea-taking, nor in the plea questionnaire, and we feel that's something essential.
Yes. And you hang that on the Austin and the Garski case, correct?
Yes. Okay. Correct. With respect to the elements of the offense, there's no specific magic words under Bangert or under any case law that requires this is what must be said, but the language that this Court has always used, as recently as the Brown case from just this past term, is that there must be a colloquy that satisfies this Court, the reviewing court, the trial judge, that there's a full working, meaningful understanding of the nature and elements of the crime to which she's pleading. That in this case, the Bangert violation occurred not in what was said, but what was in not said.
Now here, I went over it several times just to see, because having had the opportunity to take many pleas, and there's different ways to do it, Judge Radcliffe said, can you tell me what charge is that you're going to enter the plea to? And your client said, I believe it's the sexual assault of a child under the age of 16. Now, the judge then said, the information in this case, this is the explanation on the record, alleges that in August of 2003 in this county, you had sexual intercourse with a child under the age of 16. Now, she stated what she did. He stated what the information said. Now, you're saying, I believe, that he should have said, do you understand that these are the elements under 948.02? Is that what?
Yes, and not in any specific words, but this case is somewhat unique factually, because in the criminal complaint itself, there are statements in the police reports which were used to make the probable cause portion of the criminal complaint that the boy, the purported victim in the situation, had repeatedly asked her if they could have intercourse, and she repeatedly said no.
Yeah, now, does that make any difference? You had a 20-year-old, and we're talking about consent. We're talking about, are you saying that this was a forcible, non-consensual? That's what you seem to be indicating.
That's clearly what Ms. Lackershire has indicated from prior to the charging stage in this case, and I think under those circumstances, and also I'd like to point out to the court in the preliminary examination testimony of the boy, he specifically indicated that he asked her to have intercourse. And I think it does make a difference under the facts of this case that simply having intercourse with a person under 16 is not in and of itself a sexual assault of a child. I sent the court a memorandum about 10 days ago. Sorry. And I apologize for not finding that authority earlier. Obviously, it would have been relevant. However, I took the position better late than never. That suggests that if a 15-year-old assaults or has non-consensual sex with a 20-year-old, that is not a sexual assault of a child. It's a sexual assault by a child. And I think that Judge Radcliffe, in this case, based upon the preliminary hearing testimony, based on the statements right in the criminal complaint, Monica Lackershire told the police from day one when they were investigating this case, she did not consent to this sex. She said no, no, no. And then she, on some level, acquiesced to the advances of the boy. And under those circumstances, I think that's enough of a red flag that a trial judge confronted with a defendant who was not obviously the most sophisticated person would need to go a little bit further and say, well, are you suggesting that you were raped? Because when they told her you had sex with someone under the age of 16, well, that's a fact. That's indisputable. But I don't think that in and of itself makes out the crime.
Mr. Weiss, isn't the Olson case different on several levels? To begin with, you had a trial. To begin with, you had a situation where defense counsel was requesting a specific instruction, which was turned down. And here, you don't have a trial. You have the entry of a plea. How do those cases really, how does Olson really relate to this situation? I know you're saying, well, there was some indication in the criminal complaint that she had said no repeatedly. But does that necessarily trigger in the trial judge a requirement that he go further than the normal two elements of this charge?
I would say in this case it does, yes, because the issue isn't whether magic words are spoken. The issue is whether the person entering the plea and admitting the criminal conduct has a full understanding of the nature of the crime. And if Monica Lackershire is standing in front of the judge and saying, well, yes, I had sexual intercourse with this 16-year-old boy, but no, it wasn't my idea. No, I didn't want to do it. And yes, he did it to me. Yes, I do think that implicates the same issues as in the Olson case, because the Olson case specifically indicated that if the sex were not initiated by or performed by the adult, there could be no conviction.
What was used in this case to support the plea? Was it the probable cause portion of the criminal complaint?
And the testimony from the preliminary hearing, both of which are completely equivocal on the issue of whether or not she ever agreed or consented. The child's statement, the boy, come on, child, he's a 14-year-old boy, said over, he candidly told the police, well, I asked her and she said no, and I asked her again and she said no, and then I asked her a couple more times and she said no. And then she went and laid on the couch and covered herself up with a blanket. And finally, I asked her another time, and she gave me a look. So I went over and had intercourse.
Just so I understand, Judge Radcliffe would have had in front of him then what you're claiming.
Absolutely, yes. Both, and additionally, the testimony of the preliminary hearing where the district attorney specifically asked the boy, who initiated this? Whose idea was it? And the boys sort of said, well, it was maybe kind of both of ours. And then they went a little further and said, well, I asked her. And she, of course, didn't testify. And certainly, I just think this is less than a routine case. And there are enough red flags here on the elements issue that I think in this case, the plea taking itself did not go far enough to satisfy the trial judge or to inform This particular defendant, as we find her, with her various difficulties, also which were noted in the record.
Counsel, you seem to be saying that the judge being aware of this, the judge was also aware of other things. The judge was aware of other charges. The judge was aware of other things that had taken place, I believe. Now, if we're going to have a requirement that the judge, understanding there's a possible defense, that he should be discussing that, isn't that the job of the defense counsel?
It certainly could have been the job of the defense counsel. And quite honestly, when I filed the motions and went to court up in Pepin County, and understand also that Judge Radcliffe took the plea, but it was Judge Morey's case. And Judge Morey actually did the preliminary hearing and the sentencing. But when I went up to Pepin County and we began, I'm sure the court's had an opportunity to read the briefs and review the transcript of the post-conviction hearing. I've done this for a while, and I'm used to going to court on these sorts of motions. And the normal procedures, then the prosecution would have the defense counsel there and say, "Mr. Defense Counsel, didn't you explain this to her? Did you go over this with her?" They would cross-examine the defendant when I put her on the witness stand, and she said, "I had no idea about this. I thought I was raped. I didn't know that was a defense." And we're using defense in kind of two different ways, which I'd like to address for just a second. But in this case, that never happened. And it never happened, in my opinion, because the prosecution never did what it normally would do in a normal case. And when we're speaking about it being a defense, I don't mean this as a defense in the sense, and I don't think the Olson case takes it as a sense of an affirmative defense, where this is actually a defense that you could present to the jury if you chose to, and you would have to make some showing, and then the jury would decide. This is an elemental defense. In other words, it's a defense to the extent that if they can't prove that she was the initiator of this activity, or that this activity occurred at her direction, she cannot be convicted. So in that sense, it's not a defense the way we would think of self-defense, and I don't think a judge in a murder case would have to tell a defendant, "Well, do you understand there are many defenses and there might be a venue problem, and you understand that there might be a self-defense issue here, or you might be guilty of a lesser included offense that you could present." This is not that sort of defense.
This
is something where if it didn't occur in a particular way, she could not, as a matter of law, be convicted of this crime.
But does it make any difference whether this was a plea agreement? And here there were, as I understand it, two other charges. There were four charges.
Yes.
One, of course, she was convicted on, and three were dismissed.
Yeah, there were two different youths and two charges.
There were two different incidents with this young man, and then there were two different incidents with another young man of the same age, 14.
Correct.
Does that make any difference?
None whatsoever, and that almost also ties into the aspect that we're asserting that this court should recognize a rule that the failure to address the read-ins of those other offenses was also a Bangert-type violation.
Well, Mr. Weiss, let me ask you about that. I've gone through and pulled the bench book in this area, and the area regarding read-ins. Indicates that a defendant may stipulate with the defendant to read additional charges, uncharged or dismissed offenses into the record. The court can consider those offenses in imposing sentence. Read-ins are admissions by the defendant, and they're corresponding case sites. Admissions by the defendants, that's one of the distinctions between a regular dismissal, and the other distinction is that read-ins can be considered for purposes of restitution. Now, I went back, and I was surprised that I really didn't see this dealt with in either brief, but I went back and I pulled the plea transcript, I pulled the adjournment of the sentencing transcript, I pulled the sentencing transcript, I looked at the post-conviction transcript, and I looked at the guilty plea questionnaire. And as near as I can tell, at the time she entered her plea, there was no discussion of read-ins or admission to those other charges. At the time of the adjournment of the sentencing, there was no discussion of the read-ins or admissions to those charges. At the time of sentencing, the attorneys didn't argue that these were read-ins. The trial court did not consider them as read-ins. In fact, the trial court kept going back and saying, "Well, she's pleading because these other cases are being dismissed, right? Because they're being dismissed, right? Because they're being dismissed, right?" So at no time throughout the proceedings does it appear, and she never admitted to the read-in charge, so it appears that at no time during these proceedings that any of these parties treated this as a read-in. The only time that read-in came up was in the pre-sentence investigation, and the trial court did not accept the pre-sentence recommendation as to sentencing. So I guess my question is, why did the Court of Appeals, and why should we be handling this as a read-in case if it wasn't treated in the trial court as a read-in?
You're correct in your reading. I have no dispute with that. Other than at the post-conviction hearing, of course, the district attorney was very adamant that, yes, they were intended to be read-in charges, and he indicated that was his agreement with defense counsel. An interesting aspect of the case, and it's an issue I did not raise in my petition for review or in my briefs in this court, is that read-ins do two things to people. And read-ins in this case may appear in places where they have injured Monica Lackershire, however, they're not of record. It's a little bit of a big gray area. I'd like to address it a little. Tell me if I'm stepping on places I shouldn't. But in this case, the judge indicated he used the sentencing guidelines. And there's an interchange at the post-conviction hearing where I asked that they should be put in the record, and he said, no, that's just for me and the Supreme Court. And I debated that with him briefly, but the whole nature of that hearing wasn't when we were having exactly a friendly dialogue, I guess I would say.
It looked to be an interesting proceeding.
It was kind of old school, if I may. And the problem is that on the sentencing guideline sheets, which are certainly available as an authority, there's a separate box to check, were there read-ins. We don't know to this day whether that box was checked by the judge or not, because the judge did whatever it is he did with that and certainly didn't tell me. The other issue is that the Department of Corrections treats read-ins very differently from misconduct and other uncharged offenses that can be considered at sentencing. And this, again, is readily available in Department of Corrections guidelines. Read-ins are seen by the Department of Corrections as disqualifying a person from the earned release program, for example, which is obviously very important to many people. They treat a read-in the same as a conviction for those purposes, and that's laid out in their own worksheets concerning eligibility. They do not treat dismissed charges which are considered for sentencing or uncharged conduct. And we don't know to this day exactly how those are being handled. But you're correct, you know, with that long footnote, you're correct in asserting it doesn't say specifically that you are being sentenced with read-ins in mind.
Well, the reason I ask the question is because of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in United States versus Watts back in 1997, where the court held that you can consider the facts of even an acquittal.
Yes.
As long as the trial court, for purposes of sentencing, thinks that they're by preponderance of the evidence, the person committed the conduct. So it seems to me that you can, as a sentencing judge, consider a dismissal for purposes of sentencing without accepting it as a read-in where the defendant has admitted to the violation and the trial court is going to order restitution. And when I went back and looked at these transcripts and I looked at the plea questionnaire, what I saw was a dismissal. And I don't see anything that suggests that it was ever treated as a read-in other than from the pre-sentence writer. And if it's not a read-in, I guess I have some concerns about altering or changing our jurisprudence regarding read-ins. I was a trial court judge, and I recall going through and saying, hey, going through the elements of the offense with each of the read-in charges, asking the defendant, did you admit to these, to this charge that's about to be dismissed? And you may have to pay restitution. And if the defendant didn't admit, we would order the case for all counts held for trial. So I remember going through that process. So I'm concerned about altering our jurisprudence on read-ins if we're not even dealing with a read-in.
As I said, there are two quick responses to that. The first is we don't know if, even in Ms. Lackershire's own personal case, they are or are not being treated as read-ins by the Department of Corrections, which is paramount, number one. I don't dispute any of what you've said concerning even charges for which you've been acquitted, which I've always had a hard time wrapping my head around, but the court says you can do it, so it can be done. The other issue is I don't think I'm asking the court to change its jurisprudence in any way. I have laid out in my brief.
But the Court of Appeals has, and that's my concern.
I'm sorry?
The Court of Appeals has, and that's my concern.
The Court of Appeals, I think, has changed the jurisprudence, not this court. And I'm asking this court to recognize that the requirements that this court has laid out since Austin and all the way through, and in every authority has said these must be treated of record formally. The Court of Appeals has now said, oh, it doesn't really matter because, as you said, they could be considered anyway. And I'm asking this court, rather than to change the jurisprudence, I'm asking this court to tell the Court of Appeals not to change the jurisprudence and for this court to make it very expressly clear that if there are written offenses, they darn well should be laid out on the record. It takes, you know, 5 minutes. I understand
that. Mr. Weiss,
yes.
The point is, you may not think the Court of Appeals stated the law properly, but even if they didn't, your client wasn't hurt. That's what I think Justice Butler is attempting to tell you. He wasn't hurt because the trial court, there's nothing in the record showing that there were read-ins in this case. So your first two issues presented on your petition to review deal with read-ins, but this is not a read-in case on the face of the record. And if Justice Butler isn't saying it, I am.
I understand that, and as I can only respond as I have.
So you don't like particular parts of the law, but it may not affect your client. So it seems to me that your third issue that you're really arguing here is that the defendant moved to withdraw the plea, testified about her confusion and misunderstanding, and should the state produce affirmative evidence to the contrary. Isn't that your third issue?
Yes, and we're just not sure whether she was hurt or whether their read-ins are being used against her or not because the judge didn't share with anyone whether he checked the box that said read-ins.
I guess understand that.
But could I ask, Mr. Weiss, I'm not entirely clear what happened after the preliminary examination. There was a one-count charge and then a two-count information after the preliminary?
No. I believe, I'll just double-check, I don't want to misspeak. There were two separate criminal case numbers involving the two separate youths. And I believe each criminal complaint had two counts. No, I'm sorry. There was one count in the criminal complaint in this case. In the other case, I believe there were two counts with a different case number. So that case was dismissed. Then when the informations were filed, there were two counts in this case and two counts in the other case. The other information was dismissed and not read in.
The essence of what I'm asking is the defendant claiming that she was raped four times?
There's no specific testimony to that effect. The particular incident that formed the basis for the plea was very specifically the incident covered in the police reports in which she did claim she was raped from the first time, which occurred in the house. And that was the incident that she pled to, was the count that's in the criminal complaint in this case. And that is absolutely the one in which she claimed she was raped.
If this case were to go back, because there was a, quote, plea agreement, is the state then free to charge all four of these again?
Presumably, yes.
Which count did she plead to?
I'm just trying to find the information. But she pled to count one. It's in the pre-sentence report, actually. They lay out how they were charged specifically. And she pled to count one in case number 03CF32. Count two in that case was dismissed. And the two counts in case 03CF27 were also dismissed. But the count that she pled to is the very count that's addressed in the criminal complaint, which charged one count with one particular boy. And that's the count where the police reports raise these very serious questions about whether there was a crime or not.
In the pre-sentence investigation, were these the only alleged sexual assaults that were brought to the attention of the court?
They were the only current ones, yes, as far as I'm aware.
Well, who was the father of the child? Was it Stephen G. or Joseph C.?
That is something I don't know, Judge. It's not in the record.
I had the impression there was another young man.
There had been a prior occasion, I believe some years earlier, of a similar type of offense which was not handled as a second-degree sexual assault of a child. I believe there was an agreement to reduce it to a misdemeanor and a probationary period. And again, the record, I believe, other than what's listed in the pre-sentence report in her prior record, is a little bit vague in that regard, and I'm not privy to any particular documents from a record that would exactly tell us that.
You think the Olson case is good law? I know it's good law.
It's the best. Yes, I do think it's good law, because I think that if you look at their analysis of the jury instruction and the definition of sexual intercourse, it's the only sensible interpretation, really. I mean, we can't convict somebody for being a victim. And when we're dealing with people who are 15 years old, obviously, we can charge them as adults for various crimes now, so they certainly have the ability to assault someone. My lights are on. I don't know if the court has anything else.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Freimuth, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General James Freimuth, representing the state of Wisconsin as respondent in this criminal case. The defendant seeks to withdraw her guilty plea on three grounds relating to the read-in charges, the elements of the charge of conviction, and her pregnancy. The state foremost asked this Court to hold that plea withdrawal is not required on any of these claims, either as a matter of right or as a matter of discretion to correct a claimed manifest injustice. I was going to start with the read-ins, but I think I'll jump ahead to start with the elements, since that was the initial discussion here, and also to address the recent authority that was presented at State versus Olson. The state's argument on with respect to plea withdrawal regarding the Banger claim that she didn't understand the elements, three state arguments on that. The first is that, as a threshold matter, when this was pleaded in her post-conviction motion, it was not adequately pleaded, and all that was said was in a conclusory fashion, quote, that she did not fully understand the elements. There was no development, no articulation. So the post-conviction motion itself was inadequate. Now, the trial court went ahead and addressed it beyond that, but the state doesn't want to simply forego that potential argument. The second argument on the elements is that the plea colloquy was adequate. It correctly informed the defendant of the two elements of the charge of second-degree child sexual assault, that she had sexual intercourse with Stephen G. That was count one. That was the one that was that she pled guilty to, and that Stephen was under the age of 16 at the time. State versus Olson raises the question of whether the defendant's, and I'll call it for lack of a better term, non-consent, in other words, non-consent of the defendant, not the victim, non-consent of the defendant, should be treated as an element or as an affirmative defense. The state has no quarrel that in a particular case, as Olson, a jury instruction may be warranted to enable the defendant to be heard on that. The state's position is that this is not an essential element of the charge, but rather an affirmative defense. In conjunction, and I'll outline our position on this, and since this was a last-minute thing, I would respectfully request the opportunity for supplemental briefing if the court feels it necessary to deal with the merits of that issue. But when you're talking about whether a particular factor is an element versus an affirmative defense, you look both at the legislative intent and at the policy concerns. The legislative intent here focuses on the definition of sexual intercourse. Olson talked about that definition, and the last phrasing of that definition, which has language, by the defendant or at the defendant's direction. The legislative history, however, shows that that language, and this is where the state departs from Olson, that language, which initially was part of the definition of sexual intercourse in the adult statute, if you will, 940.225, I think it's 5B, that was this language by the defendant or at the defendant's instruction was added by Chapter 311 of the laws of 1981. And and that was to the 940.225. But that language and the language of sexual, or the definition of sexual intercourse in the child sexual assault statute, that's 948.01 sub 6, are identical. The legislative, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Mr. Frymuth, I'm just thinking about your argument that the Olson case sets forth an affirmative defense and not an element. Does that really make any difference when we're looking at whether or not the plea was a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary one?
I think it makes a difference in terms of the plea colloquy. In other words, if in a particular case, in order for a plea to be valid, a guilty plea to be valid, the defendant has to be aware of not only that the allegation or the element of sexual intercourse and underage of the victim, but somehow that her non-consent, in other words, that she wasn't a victim herself of rape, if that's part of the elements, then I think as part of the plea colloquy that would be necessary. Our position, of course, is that that isn't necessary when you're talking about sexual intercourse, in part because both the legislative history that I'm articulating and the policy concerns show that that part of it, in other words, the defendant's non-consent, only goes to this second alternative meaning of sexual intercourse. Sexual intercourse is defined in two parts, according to the legislative history. The first is the general understanding of, and it's in the definition, this is where it's hard because we haven't briefed it, but in the definition, the first way in which sexual intercourse is satisfied articulates four ways: vulvar penetration, cunnilingus, fellatio, fellatio, and anal intercourse. That's the first part. Then there's a second or, and that's the part where this by the defendant or at the defendant's instruction comes in, and that's where when the legislature enacted that part of it, it was meant only to the second part. That is, quote, any other intrusion, however slight, of any part of a person's body or of any object into the genital or anal opening, either by a person or upon the person's instruction. The legislative history, Chapter 311, Laws of 1981, describes what it was doing. And I'm quoting the prefatory note here. Presently, the definition of sexual intercourse in the sexual assault statute includes any intrusion of any part of a person's body or of any object into the genital or anal opening of another person. This proposal clarifies that the intrusion of the body part or object may be caused by the direct act of the offender, in parentheses defendant, or may occur as a result of an act by the victim, which is done in compliance with instructions of the offender. That's the legislative history argument as to why this shouldn't be an element of the charge of second-degree child sexual assault based on sexual intercourse in the form that it was alleged here, namely penis-vagina, vulvar penetration, penis-vagina intercourse. There's also policy reasons that support treating this as an affirmative defense rather than as an element for a plea colloquy. Child sexual assault prescribing sexual intercourse is a strict liability offense in the sense that the defendant's intent is not an element of the crime. As this court observed in State versus Coleman, a strict liability offense is subject to a defense of privilege. The defendant's non-consent to a sexual intercourse with a child, that is, the defendant's claim that she or he was raped by the child, fits this notion of privilege under the catch-all privilege part of the statute, 939.456. A defendant who truly believed that he or she was sexually assaulted by the child complainant would not plead guilty to sexually assaulting the child without having to be told at a plea colloquy that the defendant's non-consent is a complete defense. Just like in the situation of a defendant who is pleading to a charge of intentional homicide. The defendant who truly believed that he or she acted in self-defense wouldn't do that without having to be told at a plea colloquy that self-defense is a complete or partial defense. An affirmative defense.
Mr. Primer, sure. Let me ask you about your argument under privilege under sub 6. What is the basis to state that her being a victim, that is, her non-consent, falls within either a statutory privilege or a common law privilege?
Right. There, it would only be a policy common sense argument that it's an unusual situation for somebody to claim to have been a victim of the act that they're agreeing that they're pleading guilty to doing.
But the reason I ask the question is under the, if we're talking common law, that means there's some case law out there that we can rely upon. And if we're talking statute, there's got to be a statute that says that this is a defense. Otherwise, the privilege statute doesn't apply.
I understand. And I frankly, in the short time that I've had to look at this, I just haven't been able to articulate anything. That's why I'm doing it this way. And I'd like the chance to brief it. But my guess is that the rationale, and if there is a case that talks about this, is that if the defendant truly believes that he or she was a victim, they wouldn't be pleading to the act that they claim they were the victim of.
Counsel, if there's an affirmative defense, who has the burden?
Probably the state in this situation. The burden analysis depends on its own set of conditions, but probably the state, since the state here would be in the position of having to show that it was the child victim, the child complainant, who was the real actor here, the state would have to disprove that part of it. I mean, as a practical matter in this case, even if this were to be deemed, and this is where I say the court may not have to get to this particular determination, even if we say that this is an essential element, the defendant's non-consent, the defendant being a victim, the record in this case as a whole, even without going back for an additional step of the Bangert, which would be one of the state's alternative requests here, would be give us a chance, because this was never presented in the trial court as an element that the state would have to deal with. But the existing record shows that, and as Justice Wilcox pointed out earlier this morning, the defendant was asked at the plea colloquy to identify what it is that she's pleading guilty to. And the language she used was sexual assault of a 16-year-old. She wouldn't use the word assault, I don't think, if she felt like she was the victim of she didn't say having sexual intercourse with a child, she said sexual assault. And in addition, all the discussion in the plea colloquy is phrased in terms of you agree you committed this offense. Things that if the defendant truly believed that she was the victim here, she wouldn't be acknowledging. Unless there are additional questions on the elements.
The only comment I have is that the charge that she is charged with is entitled sexual assault. I mean, that's what it's called.
Sure.
Yeah.
I understand.
I mean,
I understand. I guess that's the best I can do other than going through the litany of the plea colloquy itself to suggest that she knew what she was doing here. If she truly felt that she was the victim here, she wouldn't be acknowledging all these various things that she's acknowledging. She would, for example, she wouldn't have waived the right to have the child complainant testify, for example, so that she could, and that she knew she had the right to do that, that she could cross-examine, that she could compel her own witnesses, testify herself, that in light of that history, it's really unnecessary to even resolve that particular question in this case, but since it's now been raised, we're certainly willing to address it.
If it went back, as you said, for a, quote, Bangert hearing, unquote, what would the proceeding be? Who would have to prove what?
Well, we're in for
a voluntary, knowing, and intelligent plea, right?
Right.
And we're in on a request to withdraw the plea. That's
right.
With the posture of the case. As I understand it, right?
Right?
So it goes back for a hearing on whether this was a voluntary, intelligent, et cetera, and whether or not there are grounds for withdrawal, right?
Right.
So who proves what at this?
Okay, in the banger at the first step, and this is the predicate here is that if the defendant's non-consent, that's the shorthand I'm using for her claim that she was the victim, the defendant's non-consent, if that's an element, well, certainly the plea colloquy didn't specifically say that, although, as I just suggested, the record as a whole would show that. But the state's burden, if it went back, would then, if that's an element, would be to show that the defendant, on the record as a whole, including talk or questioning the defendant, questioning the defendant's counsel, that she understood that her non-consent was a defense to this charge, whether you call it an element or an affirmative defense, that she understood that and could have proceeded to trial had that been the case. That would be what the state's burden would be at the at a remand hearing.
How about you do that for questioning her and counsel?
Primarily, I think. I mean, whatever else is in, I mean, I hesitate here to go too far, but in the pre-sentence, in the sentencing, there are multiple statements by the defendant apologizing, admitting that, quote, she's okay. a sexual deviant, quote, that she did this for sexual gratification. There's a pretty substantial record here to defeat the inference that, although she initially made statements to the police that would be exculpatory, that I'm the victim here, when it got to be the formal court proceeding, she was proceeding differently.
How about the read-in?
Okay. With respect to the read-in, I've got a holding and then two alternatives for the state's position. Here's the holding. To tender a knowing and voluntary guilty plea under a plea agreement that includes a dismissed read-in charge or charges, a defendant like Lackershire does not have to understand that a dismissed read-in charge has two collateral sentencing consequences, namely admitting that the underlying conduct occurred and that restitution may be ordered on it. Thus, a trial court does not have to undertake an on-record colloquy about these collateral sentencing consequences. Rather, Lackershire's plea withdrawal argument based on the read-ins is more properly analyzed under the discretionary manifest injustice test because a read-in charge is part of a plea agreement. And in this case, Lackershire's claim fails under that.
Let's focus in on that, Mr. Freimuth. The read-in is part of a plea agreement, and the read-in, and I'm reading right from State versus Cleaves, is where a defendant may admit in open court the commission of other charges and ask that they be taken into account. And when this is done, the sentence bars the prosecution of such admitted crime. That's on page 78 of State versus Cleaves. So when I look at read-in and what has been described by the Court of Appeals and our court and defined, I don't see this as a read-in charge. Nowhere in here do you have an admission by the defendant of the other charges. So if you don't have an admission, then how can we call this a read-in? And I have a follow-up question that I want to ask you about the Court of Appeals opinion, but why don't you deal with that first?
Sure. I think there's a real initial problem here as to whether, in fact, as you point out, whether this was treated or believed to be a read-in. The first, it was not mentioned at the plea. It's not mentioned at the sentencing. It directly on the sentencing record. It appears first in the language of the pre-sentence report. Then when you get to the post-conviction hearing, the prosecutor says to the court that I and defense trial counsel treated this or agreed to this as read-in. So that's where the state's assumption, if you will, that this was a read-in offense stems from. Now, as a practical matter, and why I think
if it was a read-in, yeah. Then doesn't she have to admit to it in order for the read-in to take effect?
Well, you're right. I mean, if this was a read-in agreement, and the term of the plea agreement was that, you know, you're reading these in, then by her, she would have to understand that she's admitting the underlying conduct of the reading and that it's subject to restitution. We don't have specific admissions to that effect. We have general admissions, I'm sorry, this I did this, and so forth.
Don't the cases indicate that that has to be done on the record?
Well, I think, right. I think Cleaves suggests that it's a desirable to do it, and we don't have any qualm with making it a desirable thing. We just don't think, based on our analysis of the cases, and if you compare it, as I have a laundry list of other collateral consequence cases, that this is something that needs to be part of the plea agreement. I think when a trial court is, and part of the problem here is probably defining what read-in means, and certainly for a defendant to understand. Read-in means, or I'm sorry, from the defendant's standpoint, when there's a plea agreement, any charge that is dismissed as part of the plea agreement can't be recharged and prosecuted. That's certainly the understanding that I think Lackershire had here. So whether you characterize it as a read-in, meaning the admitting the underlying conduct and the restitution, or whether you characterize it as a dismissal where the defendant understood that she can't be charged again, that was her goal. I don't think
I understand
and
that.
And I think at sentencing, she proceeded on the understanding that she wasn't worried about whether I'm admitting the underlying conduct or not. That's not affecting her plea decision.
Well, the reason I ask the question is I'm concerned about paragraph 14 of the Court of Appeals decision, where the court very loosely discussed the Cleaves case, used a quote, and the quote was the very last sentence of the Court of Appeals opinion in Cleaves. In the absence of any objection to the crimes being read in, the court may assume that the defendant admits them for purposes of being considered at sentencing. Now, that's the last sentence. That's what we call the bookend.
Right.
But if you go back, that has to relate to the opinion. And when you look at page 78 of Cleaves, the court in discussing Sarkowitz and Austin, specific Sarkowitz, in Sarkowitz, the court wrote that in Wisconsin, when a defendant agrees to the crimes being read in at the time of sentencing, he makes an admission that he committed those crimes. Thus, our read-in procedure dictates that when a defendant agrees to the read-in, he or she admits the crimes occurred. Now, that's what we're talking about. In the absence of an agreement where the defendant has done it on the record, as all the other cases seem to suggest, I'm concerned about the published Court of Appeals opinion that seems to suggest you don't have to go through that analysis. Can you sit here and defend this Court of Appeals opinion?
Well, I think it starts from the proposition of, is it absolutely necessary as part of a valid plea to make sure the defendant understands that a charge that is being dismissed is one at which the defendant is, for purposes of her sentencing, or his sentencing, admitting the underlying conduct. If that's critical to the plea, not just to the sentencing, but to the plea, in other words, if the defendant really doesn't make a distinction between, well, I'm admitting it for purposes of sentencing, or, you know, I'm not worried about that part of it, I just want to make sure I'm not going to be prosecuted on it, then it doesn't make so much difference. But there's a difference, I think, between the plea consequence, the validity of the plea, and the sentencing consequence. I'm not suggesting, as I think I said in my brief, that it isn't a good idea. I'm just saying that under the current state of the law, that it is not necessary as part of a plea colloquy.
Well, it's not necessary if it's just being handled for purposes of sentencing. I understand the State's position there. My concern is treating it as a read-in for purposes of sentencing.
Right.
There seems to me to be a distinction between just a straight dismissal where, as part of the plea negotiations, the person can't be charged, and a read-in where the court is seeking an admission from the defendant and saying, I can hit you up for restitution.
Right. And I think, you know, certainly the plea questionnaire talks about restitution at least. I mean, if the plea questionnaire had said, and you're admitting the other, then we wouldn't have that problem also. But, I mean, I guess I don't have a strong objection to making it part of a plea colloquy, but I think under the analysis of other case law that talks about collateral consequences of a plea, it's not, you know, it's just not something that you think of in terms of something that's required. I mean, certainly in this case, again, I would suggest that this defendant could not reasonably have been worried about whether she was admitting those other three charges. Her concern was, I'm not going to be prosecuted on those other three charges. I think that's a fair reading of the record. If she had really believed that she didn't do this and that she was not foreclosed at sentencing from objecting to the other read-in crimes, you would have expected some protest from her or at least some comment to that effect, and that's not present on this record.
Counsel, I heard you say you have no objection to it, and I want to make sure I heard you correctly and then give you a chance to embellish on it. I thought I heard you say that you have no objection to making this part of the plea colloquy. That is, this, I assume, being that the read-in offense be on the record, that there's an admission to the underlying conduct.
Sure. I would suggest that it's not as a requirement necessarily of a valid plea in the sense of the other Bangert requirements. Although, I mean, I guess the impetus would be that you're suggesting by making it part of a colloquy that it is in some fashion vital to the plea. I disagree with that part of it, but I don't have an objection to making sure the defendant understands those things. If It's circular because on one hand I want to say these are collateral. These are sentencing, collateral sentencing consequences, so why does the defendant have to know? If it's more than that, then certainly it should be part of the plea colloquy. Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm pushing it a bit, yeah. Because there is an argument that is made by your opposing counsel that, hey, Court of Appeals was a little, was an error here because the law is settled. Your position is not only, well, the law is not settled the way that your opposing counsel indicates it. That is your position, as I understand. There is no requirement under the law that it be on the record. Might be better practice, but it's no requirement that it be on the record.
For a valid plea, right. And I think the language in Cleaves here that Justice Butler cited probably isn't apt here because it wasn't really called to the defendant's attention. These are read-ins, so that to assume that she is operating as if they were read-ins without being it called to her attention, although, I mean, she did have the chance to look at the PSI where it was only mentioned, the only mention of it, that's probably not good enough to really put this defendant on notice that you're admitting the underlying conduct. The reality is that this wasn't really a concern. That's the State's position in this case. Well, future, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say in the pre-sentence, as I understood it, and I, you can correct me, as I understood the pre-sentence, they read it, I'm talking about the defense, and there was, and they not only read it, but they had no objection to it.
That's correct. In fact,
they understood what it said, and that was said by both.
They actually initiated, or the original sentencing was postponed for a week to give the defendant and counsel time to go through the pre-sentence. Now, whether defense counsel pointed out to Lancashire in their discussions in reading the pre-sentence report, this says read it and this is what it means, we don't have that developed in the record, but that's what the mention was. There was a section near the beginning of the pre-sentence that just mentioned these others as read-in offenses. One thing I would also note in conjunction here as a support for the proposition that this isn't a plea withdrawal necessity here is that when she claimed that the testimony at the post-conviction hearing from the defendant was that she didn't understand, she thought these were going to be dismissed completely. Now, of course, if it was completely, that would mean not as part of a plea bargain, presumably, and that would mean that she's still subject to charging on that, and that certainly wasn't her understanding. Her understanding was, I believe, that these weren't going to be, she wasn't going to be prosecuted on it. That's what her concern was. She wasn't concerned about, well, am I admitting the conduct? I mean, I don't think that's a fair reading of the record. The trial court, moreover, although, again, this isn't precise language when we're talking about these hearings, but the trial court disbelieved her comment that she didn't know that, you know, when she said that she thought these were going to be dismissed completely, disbelieved her for whatever merit that has.
Of what moment is it that defense counsel was not called as a witness by the state at the Bangert hearing in this case, or the post-conviction hearing in this case? I would expect the defense counsel in this case to be called sure. by the state. And in fact, the cross-examination of the defendant was very abbreviated and did not even touch upon the read-in issue. So, of what moment is it the burden of proof comes into my mind as a state met its sure. burden of proof with the paltry evidence it put in?
Sure, a couple of things. First, of course, if there was a claim that defense counsel did something inept or ineffectively, that would be the defendant's requirement. In a Bangert situation where the burden shifts to the state would have the opportunity and the requirement to show that despite an inadequate plea colloquy, presumably here, and I can't speak for the prosecutor, he probably believed that their existing record, certainly on the two elements of sexual assault, not talking about the Olson matter, which wasn't presented below, and the read-in aspect of it was sufficiently addressed that there would be no need for counsel. I can't speak beyond that, but I guess I'm suggesting that certainly with respect to both the read-in, in terms that, meaning that I don't think that at the time of the post-conviction hearing in motion, Wisconsin law clearly required a read-in part of a colloquy, so that not giving the state a chance now to go back and address that if that's where the court's headed would be improper to do.
Well, let me just, it appears to me by reading the part of the transcript that actually is, I don't know, I think it was what I have with regard to the of the post-conviction hearing, that read-in was an issue of the post-conviction hearing. I mean, the judge even made reference to the read-in. So it's part of the post-conviction hearing, an issue raised for purposes of post-conviction. How can this court say the state sustained its burden of proving sustained its burden at this hearing with regard to read-in when it put in no evidence regarding read-in?
Right. Yeah, I think, I mean, it, again, just to reiterate, I think that the state's position for not doing the second step of Bangert with respect to read-ins was the state, the prosecutor I'm talking about now at the time of the hearing, either didn't believe that, and I think rightly so, under Wisconsin law, that it wasn't part of the plea colloquy, and therefore we're talking about something that really isn't a Bangert issue as opposed to a manifest injustice, you know, part of the plea bargain, did she get what she was entitled to get kind of discussion. If the court reads the record differently, and the motion and the procedure, then I think the state probably has been given its chance on that issue. Now, on the Olson issue, I think is a different story. I mean, there was no suggestion below or even in the appellate brief that we're talking about a third element to child sexual assault.
Paragraph 21 is interesting. It deals with the coercion issue. Paragraph 21 of the Court of Appeals. Now, the Court of Appeals says Bakashaya made no showing that she asked for a postponement, that there was any medical requirement of a postponement, and nothing was brought in. Therefore, the court considered it her own testimony unreliable. Then it says, finally, we note that in most circumstances, pregnancy is the result of a conscious and consensual choice to engage in sexual intercourse. When that is the case, as it appears here, the pregnancy is a self-imposed coercive element that will not render a plea involuntary. Does that mean as a matter of law?
No, I think that's...
What does that mean?
Well, I think it's a truncated analysis. I mean, I think when we're talking about would it have made a difference to a voluntariness of a plea, you have to look at beyond just the fact of the pregnancy itself. Just as a matter, before I see my time's up and I'll answer this, but I just wanted to address... The child that she was carrying at the time of the pregnancy, according to the PSI, there was a DNA analysis done, and it was the child. The father was the victim of the of a 2001 fourth-degree sexual assault, is what she pled to, and it was down to a misdemeanor. So that was the child that she was carrying. So in that sense, having admitted guilt to being consensual, but in terms of the analysis for due process. If somebody compelled her, if a government actor or the court compelled her to stand trial, for example, to forego, you can't have a plea agreement if you're going to ask for a continuance of trial. That's not what was developed here or shown. It wasn't that kind of a coercion, and I think that's what the Court of Appeals means, although it didn't really articulate it in any expanded manner.
Thank you,
Mr. Freimuth.
I'm sorry, Justice
Mr. Freimuth, I have one other question.
Sure.
In the Brown case last term, the court restated the requirements of the plea colloquy. It's still not entirely clear to me. Let's say you had been sitting at the table as we were working through that. On the basis of existing law, what should we have said, if anything, about read-ins in that plea colloquy?
Well, my first position is that it's not necessary to be part of a colloquy. If it's going to be part of a colloquy, it has to have some bearing on some consequence to the plea decision, which, for a variety of reasons I listed, I don't think is the case. But if you're going to do it, and I start with saying don't do it, but if you're going to do it, then presumably you have to identify that what a read-in means, which is that these charges are being dismissed as part of a plea agreement, so you can't be prosecuted on them. The plea questionnaire, I think, already says that.
Saying don't do it. On the basis of the existing cases, should we have done it?
I guess since it hasn't been an issue since Austin was decided 35 years ago, I just don't see it as being normally a big issue. And I think it runs a potential risk in a couple of ways. One is you have to make very clear what read-ins means then so everybody's on the same page, as opposed to a charge that's dismissed but still capable of being recharged. And also that now you're going to add something that you have to make sure a trial judge then is going to have to do each time. Now, I think, you know, most often it probably is being done already, perhaps based on the bench book. But all I'm saying is that I don't think for a constitutionally valid plea it's necessary. Whether you think that it's a good idea because it would enhance the voluntariness or the knowingness of a plea, then I think, you know, then you have to be careful how you do that.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Wise, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Hang on, Steve. Sorry. That's okay.
Mr. Weiss, could I ask you right off the bat? I wrote the Brown decision and tried to restate fairly fully what was required at a plea colloquy. Did I goof?
I wouldn't say that you goofed, Judge. I think that the language in Brown, and there's a particular sentence or two in there where it says that the trial judge should grab a... I guess I'm looking at paragraph 56. It says, moreover, we encourage circuit court judges to translate legal generalities into factual specifics when necessary to ensure the defendant's understanding of the charges. That comes in the context of your discussion of the elements and the nature of the crime. But I think, in addition, it would have been applicable to the terms of the plea agreement, which was also discussed in Brown. And I think that what needs to be done in each individual case, as this Court has always known, and I know many of you, most of you, I guess many rather than most, have been trial judges, and each case is different, each defendant is different, and sometimes an extraordinarily cursory plea colloquy with a written plea questionnaire and an active defense counsel and an active alert defendant is absolutely sufficient to satisfy everyone that there's a full understanding of what's going on. Other cases where there may or may not be read-ins, there's a somewhat deficient defendant, there's a somewhat passive defense counsel, a somewhat cursory proceeding is not sufficient. And this case falls into that second category where...
I'm sorry. Finish.
So I guess, again, I don't think there's an absolute script, and I know that there's been a study going on with the, I think they call it the PPAC committee, about do we need a real good script. And a script is helpful. There's been a script for as long as I can remember in Special Matter 32 of the jury instructions. And I understand, you know, the trial judges are pressured, and I've done trial work and appellate work. There's time constraints on the one hand. On the other hand, there's a huge amount of time spent both in post-conviction that never gets to court from people who are dissatisfied or claim they didn't understand what happened. Then the cases that do come to court, there are trial court proceedings, evidentiary proceedings, appellate proceedings, Supreme Court proceedings, all of which could be obviated if at the initial plea taking it took 20 minutes instead of 5 minutes. And we're putting people in prison for 10, 20, 30, 50 years. If we need to spend 20 minutes to do it, I say that's important enough that we do.
Did Brown suggest to counsel they look at SM-32?
Yes.
And SM-32 says, establish the voluntariness of the plea. Number 12 said, is there a plea agreement? If there's a plea agreement, put it on the record with footnote 10 and establish the defendant's understanding of the agreement. Footnote 10, and of course we're not bound by this. This is... a suggestion, but footnote 10 says, if the plea agreement includes read-ins, the description of the agreement must include them, citing Austin. The offenses which are read in should be identified as accurately as possible
to avoid later questions about the scope of the prosecutor's promise not to charge the other offenses. What do you make of that?
I make of that that the read-ins should be placed on the record, that there's an unbroken chain of case law, if not absolutely commanding that it must be done, certainly saying it should be done. And part of the reason why I assume in my own mind this court accepted review in this case is to determine whether or not the court needs to once again say it should be done and here's how it should be done and this is the ramifications if it's not done. And I think the ability to do that is to say it is equally a part of the Bangor requirements or the 97108 requirements as all of the other things that are discussed.
Counsel, you argue about the status of the law being that it's required, or at least I hear you make that argument. And I'm not so sure. Justice Butler made reference to the last sentence in the Cleaves opinion, and if I recall, that had a footnote attached to it saying, yes, you know, doing the stuff regarding read-ins is the better practice. When I look at the Garski case, you know, quoting Austin, you should do this. That's not the language of you must, you shall. So what is the status of the law?
Well, I think the Cleaves case must be understood for the facts of the Cleaves case, which is that in Cleaves, the prosecutor, the defense counsel, and I believe the judge all referenced the specific read-ins. They had case numbers, identified the crimes. The only issue in Cleaves was whether the defendant had to make a specific express admission. And the language in Cleaves that we can assume that in the absence of an objection, the defendant admits them, flowed from the record in Cleaves where it was stated on the record. We're reading in case number 03, blah, 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 where you were charged with this. And then they didn't simply take a plea to it. And that was really the facts of Cleaves. And Cleaves even indicated they should do that. I guess my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss.
May I just mention, I certainly apologize again for the Olson matter, and I have no objection if the court does wish to take up Mr. Fryman's invitation to further briefing.
Thank you.
I apologize for the tardiness of that.
Mr. Fryman, the court will advise you if it will advise you to Mr. Weiss whether it wants a supplemental briefs on the Olson case. Barring that, this case is now closed. Zero for hearing 05AP 1189CR, State versus Lancashire. And I want to thank both counsel for their arguments this morning.